Bueno, vamos a presentar formalmente entonces este momento que esperábamos todos, la videoconferencia con el doctor Leo Beranek, desde Boston, Estados Unidos. La presentación estará a cargo de el ingeniero Federico Millara.
Bueno, todos conocemos quién es el doctor Beranek, que estamos acá viéndolo en la pantalla. Realmente es muy emocionante para nosotros haber podido conseguir esta conexión. Por favor, no sé si podés ir traduciéndole lo que estoy diciendo para que él también escuche o no. Bueno, decía que es muy emocionante para nosotros poder tenerlo acá en forma virtual. Fue una cosa que estuvimos durante mucho tiempo tratando de conseguir y bueno, finalmente lo estamos consiguiendo y estamos muy emocionados. Así que, bueno, pues estamos en condiciones de comenzar con la conferencia.
Well, good morning. I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to speak to you. I'm very fond of Argentina. In 1947, believe it or not, I was invited by the faculty of the Ciencias Exactas, the Universidad de Buenos Aires, as a visiting professor to teach a course on electroacoustica. The lectures took place in the Instituto Radio Técnico. Even though I lectured in English, I had 20 students who sat throughout the semester while wearing coats in an unheated lecture room. My family and I lived on Calle Arenales, and we took advantage of the parks and the zoo and visited the suburbs and nearby cities. We went to concerts, opera, and movies, as well as going to parties by English-speaking friends. Now, my choice of lectures for today is designed to teach you how to calculate the sound attenuation in line ducts, how to better make equivalent electrical circuits of structures like loudspeakers and microphones, and to acquaint you with the best concert halls and opera houses in the world. Now, this kind of got me going by remembering that in 1950 I received a telephone call from the National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Lewis Flight Propulsion Laboratory in Cleveland, Ohio. We'll call that NASA or NASA Cleveland. They had started up a jet engine in a supersonic wind tunnel. The noise that was produced was so intense that the city of Cleveland ruled that they could not operate the tunnel again except for measurement purposes. Members of my company, Bolt, Bronick, and Newman, and I made measurements of the noise while the engine was operating, and we also measured the background noise in the surrounding neighborhoods. Our data showed that the supersonic tunnel noise with the engine operating had to be reduced by about 30 decibels between 5 and 300 hertz and about 20 decibels at frequencies above 300 hertz to stop these complaints from the neighborhoods. This is an enormous amount of noise reduction. Now, how did I do it? I thought immediately of an experiment that I had run the year before where I had obtained an amazing amount of sound reduction in a duct that was 3/10 of a meter square and lined on four sides with a porous material. In fact, for the sound wave that was traveling down the duct at 1500 hertz, I got 24 decibels reduction for each meter that the wave traveled. I decided that I could use this finding to obtain the large amount of sound reduction I needed in Cleveland. Now, I'm going to lead you through the whole process that led to my success with this enormous noise reduction in NASA Cleveland. I hope that some here or someone here will make use of this method in the future, because it's not well known in the literature. Now let us start our discussion with a 3/10 meter square duct lined on four sides with a porous acoustical material. To calculate the duct accurately, we need to know the acoustic impedance of the acoustical material that lines the duct. Now, we can easily calculate this using electric circuit theory. Electrical circuit diagram for the acoustical structure is shown, the acoustical structure is shown on the left, and the diagram is shown on the right. And here, Z sub D equals P over U, where the sound pressure P is like voltage, and the sound velocity U is like I. And so you have Z is equal to R plus JX. And with no airspace, you can calculate these. They're very simple. The inductance is only 4/10 of the thickness of the material. The material thickness is D. And the capacitance is 1.25 D times 10 to the minus 5th. And the R is equal to the resistance per meter times the thickness over 3. And these resistances per meter on many materials are in the literature. If you put an airspace in, then you have to add a C2 and an L2 and an R2, and they have very simple values also. Now, actually in acoustics, we usually divide the quantity Z by the quantity rho C, which is equal to about 407, so that you have Z over rho C equals R over rho C plus JX over rho C. On the next slide, we see the calculated impedance RC and X, R over rho C and X over rho C for a material that's 2.5 centimeters thick. This impedance is shown for both no airspace behind and 3.3 centimeters behind. And the shape of the R over rho C and X over rho C are what you would expect for a series inductance, capacitance, and resistance. And this is the way it looks. It's normal acoustic impedance, typical material, no airspace, and this airspace of 3.3 centimeters are shown. The bottom curve is for no airspace, and then you have less impedance reactance for the airspace. Now, for our line duct, the result we want is a decibels reduction in the sound wave for each meter that the wave travels along the duct. Now, we need two charts to do this. These charts are based on a theory by P.M. Morse for a duct with a lining on one side, but I modified his theory to make it valid for a duct lined on four sides. Now, bear with me as we go through these charts, and I know some of you may think you'll never make any use of this, but you might. First of all, what we want to do is to get the dB per meter attenuation of a wave traveling in a square duct. And the duct is lined on four sides, 2.5 centimeters of material. The open air width is L equals 3/10 of a meter. Now we start with the impedance from the previous slide. And also we can write this, as you know, Z over rho C is the magnitude of Z over rho C, e to the j phi, where Z over rho C is the square root of the sum of the squares of the two, and phi equals the inverse tangent of X over rho C divided by R over rho C. Now, we do need one other quantity in this, and this relates the width of the duct to the half wavelength of the frequency at which we are determining this dB per meter. And this quantity is eta equals L, which is the duct width, divided by lambda over 2, where lambda is the wavelength. Now, we're going to need two charts to get this dB per meter. The first chart needs the quantities of taking 2 times the magnitude of Z divided by eta times rho C, and the phi divided by 13.2. And we're going to consider a frequency first in this calculation of 1500 hertz. And now the lambda is the speed of sound divided by the frequency, so you can get that eta is equal to 2.62. Now, the impedance of the acoustic material is the same as that on the previous chart, so we find then that 2Z over eta rho C is 2.66, and B over 13.2 is a minus 1.27, and that takes us to chart number 1 of Morse's charts. And this is a way of converting those two quantities into something we call kappa and mu. These are intermediate quantities. And we've already said that these two numbers were 2.66, and that should be a minus 1.27. And when you go into this chart, you go up the side to 2.7, and then you go across the bottom to a minus 1.27, and you get up in the chart up in here somewhere, and you get the two numbers that mu is equal to 0.270 and kappa is equal to 0.245. Now we got those two numbers, and now to go to the second chart, we have to booger them a little, and we need 2.83 mu over eta and 2.83 kappa over eta. So at 1500 hertz, the first one of those is 0.292, the second one is 0.265, and we go to the second chart, and you put in the 2.92 along the top, and the 0.265 along the bottom, and you follow these lines down, and what you discover is you get a sigma equal to 0.1 and a tau equal to 1.0. Now this 0.1 comes about because this chart on the left is 1 for the maxima, halfway down is 5/10. So 1/10 is up near the bottom, and so you're over in the chart where tau is about 1. These curves all came down that way. And from this chart, we have obtained this sigma equals 0.10. Now we have to convert it to dB per meter using the formula that dB per meter is 54.6 times the sigma over lambda. And remember that lambda is equal to the speed of sound divided by frequency, and that gave us lambda is 0.23 meters. Hence, the dB per meter that we calculate using that formula now is 24 dB per meter, and that's an amazingly large amount. And that takes us to the next slide, which shows what we plot. We just calculated at 1500 hertz. If you look along the bottom scale, you see 1500 hertz is where that peak is, and that is a maximum loss of the wave going down the duct of 24 dB in a meter. But then I also made calculations, 100 and 200 and 300 and all these others, and get this curve, which is a way that you would find that different waves of different frequencies travel down the duct. Now, I'm going to use that method in calculating this NASA-Cleveland wind tunnel. Now, let's go to a picture of the completed wind tunnel. And we have that in front of you now, I hope. And the completed wind tunnel is an enormous thing. On the long side, it's 68 meters long. And that section that's in the middle there, that you see right in the very middle of it, it has a dimensions of 10 by 15 meters. To give you an idea of how big this thing is. Now, not shown on the lower left corner of this is where the muffler connects with the supersonic wind tunnel. The wind tunnel is 2.5 meters by 1.8 meters in cross section. Now, in the muffler itself, there are three parts. There is a trumpet part, which reduces the noise for the 5 hertz to 20 hertz, and the duct muffler, which is the middle part, and then there's the outlet chamber, which reduces the noise above 500. So we depend on this middle part to take care of us between 20 and 500 hertz. Now I'm going to only discuss the middle part because these others take a lot of time to do. And now if you just leave that muffler picture on, I'm going to read some material that go with it. The trumpet muffler portion of the muffler consisted of a number of Helmholtz resonators, which are located between the partitions shown. Along the bottom there, you see there are partitions in that thing. And this means that you could tune these spaces, and the frequencies we tuned them to were 4.8, 6.2, 7.7, 9, and so on, up to 20 hertz. Actually, there were about 8 different muffler spaces in that. And they gave us about 25 decibels of attenuation between 5 and 18 hertz. Now, we needed 5 dB more from our studies, But we got that by putting in these bends on the two ends. So the sound goes up through that tube and has to turn 90 degrees, go through the duct muffin and turn 90 degrees to get outdoors. Now the Lewis laboratory engineers said that there must be no back pressure on the engine under test. This, they said, required an open space in the muffler of 54 square meters. And so it was decided to divide the duct muffler into six ducts, each with an open space of 3 meters square. Now if you look at the cutaway, just the beginning of that duct muffler thing, you can see that there are those six ducts in there. And today I'm only going to talk about this duct muffler. Next slide. The duct muffler, you saw in that break open space there, it's in the 10 by 15 meter cross section, and each open space is 3 meters by 3 meters. So you can see how big that is if you go walking down it. And then the duct muffler portion was 27.6 meters long, and it had to cover the frequency range of 20 and turned out to 800 hertz. Now I decided to line each duct with panels that were 0.15 meters thick. And these panels were filled with a fiberglass material. And behind the fiberglass filled panels, there's an airspace at the sixth of a meter wide. So if you look up at this picture, you can see that the material is inside, and that material is only 0.15 meters thick, and then you have the airspace 6/10 behind it. And otherwise, it's concrete structure, and the concrete everywhere is 30 centimeters thick. Now, from the Morse's theory that was just described, I then calculated the dB per meter. And that's shown by this upper curve on this slide. And you can see that we're looking for something that's going to be about 1.2, and this is written dB per foot, which means about 4 decibels per meter. So that peak is 4 decibels per meter. And that is the curve that you'd expect. But there's a problem. And that is whenever you open up a space behind the acoustical material, the sound waves can travel in that space along the duct. And if they travel in that space along the duct, you're going to lose on your peak. So what we did was set up a model. And the model was a 2.5 to 1 scale model, so that the 100 cycles that this peak is to be in the finished muffler was actually in the model 250 hertz. And so we then studied, but we didn't get that peak. We got these other two. Now, the first one of these shown with dashes is kind of wild. And we got that by putting in barriers every 2 meters, I think. We put in the barriers about every 2 meters down in that space so the wave couldn't travel all the way through. But if you put them in uniformly, you've got the dash curve, and if you space them kind of randomly so they're not all the same distance apart, you can smooth that out and you get the curve that's a little bit below. But what this showed us is that if you went between 300 and about 280, 300 is a 3 on the bottom scale there, and 280 is off to the right between 2 and 3, you could get an attenuation of at least 5/10 of a decibel per foot, and you multiply that by 3 something, and you can see you get more per meter. That'd be about 4 decibels per meter. And so now this showed then that we really had to put in those spacers in this thing, which we did in the completed muffler. Now, the completed muffler, the attenuation as measured in it was 1.6 dB per meter between 200 and 600 hertz. And this attenuation in the 27.6 meter long duct was much more than the 20 decibels needed to eliminate the noise in the neighborhoods around the laboratory. Now I told the NASA Lewis people that the duck buffer portion of this thing was could be half as long, but they decided to build the full length because the only data we had were taken in the 2.5 to 1 model, and they said, what if the constructed muffler is not as good as you predict from the model, and we've got to have the quiet that the neighborhoods demand. So the full 27.5 meters was constructed, and I'm happy to say the completed muffler measured exactly as we predicted from the model. And that finishes that, and of course, there was no more complaints from neighbors when they made their tests. Then I want to spend a little time on contributions to the loudspeaker design. In my acoustics course at MIT, I put together a new way to determine the performance of loudspeakers. I first presented this in my lectures at the Instituto Radio Tecnico in 1947. My book, Acoustics, which is still available from the Acoustical Society of America, has been translated into Spanish, and some of you may know about it, even though it's an older book. The material below is really came about from and first was published in Acoustics. Now, I was the first person to develop an equivalent electrical circuit that had all three of the domains in it, the electrical part of a loudspeaker, the mechanical part, and the acoustical part of the loudspeaker. And my reasoning started with the representation on the next slide, which I want to show is an advantage of dealing with the mobility type of circuit. Now, in the mobility type of circuit, You, if you're going to use electric circuit theory, you have force flowing through like current, and the electrical velocity is like voltage, which is kind of the opposite of the way you might think. But let's look at the loudspeaker. If you look at it on the left, you see you've got a cone that moves in and out, right and left, and it's actuated by a magnet, and there's a coil inside that magnet, and when you put any voltage into that coil, that of course there'll be a force produced that will move this cone back and forth. The cone that moves will have a mass, and at the edges up there, that number 2, if you can see it, shows the that goes all around the speaker is the spring that is a restoring force to bring that keep that in the center position. Now, when you do that, you say all these things have exactly the same velocity. There's the cone, the coil, the cone, and the spring. And so you can put in the cone with a mass M, and one end of it has to be to ground. You can't, masses don't just hang loose. The other end is due to gravity, and that's ground. And then the spring, we have this springiness, this stiffness that comes in the edge. Looks like a spring, and then use a dashpot to represent any losses, friction losses in there, and then this loudspeaker radiates both to the right and to the left, and we have to put that in as a radiation impedance on the right and on the left. That means there's two of those in there, but since all of those move with the same velocity, you can just say that's a top bar moving up and down and pulling all these things up and down. Now, when we put that in electrical circuit theory, on the right-hand side, we just put the mass-looking thing is a capacitance, the spring-looking becomes an inductance, the dashpot becomes a resistance, and the two things on the right are the Z sum R over 2, the radiation impedance. And again, those numbers you get off the charts. Now, this sort of is the thing that we developed. Now, note, keep this slide just for a second. Note here that the electrical side is brought into the circuit by means of a transformer. You can see the transformer there, where in the end of bay is the law that E is equal to BL, U. In other words, the voltage on one side, and that comes about any kind of a coil that's in the magnetic field. You put a voltage across it, and depending on the strength of the field, which is B, the length of the wire on the coil, you're going to get a movement, a velocity out of it that's U. And that gets in through a transformer, and that was a new thing that I put in. And of course, you have to bring in the inductance of the voice coil and the resistance of the voice coil. You've got a generator on it, as we do. You have a voltage here and the internal impedance of the generator, which is usually a resistance. And so that is the form. Now, if you go to the next slide, which shows the two other circuits, A and B, you can get rid of the transformer by using either one of the circuits below. If you stick with a constant voltage generator and trying to get rid of it, you got to bring in the BL into the voltage and the resistance, you bring in the B squared L squared, and the inductance, you bring in the L over B squared L squared. And you can also transform that into a constant current generator with using further way of jiggling them. And believe it or not, these two things are equivalent. But most engineers are uncomfortable with a circuit that equates mass to a condenser and compliance to an inductance. Also, engineers desire a circuit that shows the elements in series instead of we showed them in that mobility thing in parallel. So I invented a means, next slide, for making this conversion by taking the dual using the technique that follows. You get an outside point, which is point 6 here, and you go through the generator itself, we'll call one in the middle. You go through the inductance and resistance generator, we go to two in the middle. We go through that mass, we go through the dash pot, we go through the spring, and we go out to the radiation impedances and come back. And wherever you cross, you change to the opposite thing. You go through a constant current, you go to a constant voltage. If two things are in series, you put them in parallel. If this is a capacitance above, below it becomes a mass. If you have a resistance above in parallel, it goes in series on the next one. And similarly, the load impedances out here are on the right. Now we've got a series circuit, which means that it's very much easier to look at. It takes into account everything about a loudspeaker in that one circuit. Now when we go to the next thing, it's still the same circuit, except that now I'm going to say that the loudspeaker will be mounted in a closed box. Now the box looks like a compliance, C sub AB on the right in this circuit. Say the word box above. Now, but that capacitance is really in series with the capacitance C sub AS, which is the spring at the edge of the loudspeaker cone. And these two are in series. And of course, they then will resonate with the inductance to give you a resonance at some frequency. Now, two of my students were Edgar Vilcher and Henry Close, and they looked at this circuit and said, quotes, "Let us mount the voice coil on a very flexible suspension." That's sort of allowing it to float. That is to say, it's going to have a very large compliance C sub AS in the middle of that circuit. And even a relatively small box, say 0.25 meters cubed, will have a very large capacitance C sub AB in this circuit. And so the two of them together are still going to have quite a large capacitance, which means that when you combine that with the mass, you're going to get a lower frequency than in the old cases where they had a very stiff edge to the cone. It was not floating free. In those days, we had to use a very big box to get this resonant frequency down reasonably low, because the resonant frequency is really determined by the mass M sub AD and the capacitance C sub A3. Now, what they said, now we got these things very large, we now have got the resonant frequency of the loudspeaker low, so we're going to get much better bass out of the loudspeaker, even though the box is very small, like 0.25 meters cubed. And the only negative feature is the radiation efficiency of the cone is lower at low frequencies, and it means you have a little bit more powerful amplifier. Now, their innovation means that today we have loudspeakers in shelf-sized boxes with good bass response. Before, loudspeaker boxes were very large. Now I'm going to take something which I think you'll find much more interesting, probably, concert halls and opera houses. Now, the acoustics of concert halls and opera houses have been my principal interest through most of my professional life. In 1955, an unusual opportunity arose for me to make a detailed study of the acoustics of concert halls. I traveled and attended concerts in England, 5 cities, Austria, 2 cities, Germany, 6 cities, Denmark, France, Finland, 2 cities, the Netherlands, Sweden, Switzerland, 3 cities, and the United States, 14 cities. I interviewed 23 outstanding conductors. I met with them and had personal interviews, and 21 music critics in 17 cities. Technical data were obtained from acoustical measurements made in all the halls from acousticians around the world that gave me all their acoustical data. Now, these studies reveal that the best liked halls are shaped like shoeboxes. That's, they're rectangular. They're not wide, usually less than 26 meters, and they have reverberation times, that's fully occupied, in excess of 1.8 seconds. Now, fan-shaped halls, where the hall gets wider as you go back, are the least well-liked, and then the halls in which the audience surrounds the orchestra, you sort of get mixed acoustics. In the surround halls, usually there are a number of seats with excellent acoustics, much like that in the shoebox halls, but there are locations in the hall where some sections of the orchestra are emphasized over others, other locations where the music seems to come from a side surface, and others where the sound just plain is not natural. Now, I want to make a mention that throughout my studies, I've had the privilege of working with 3 acoustical engineers who traveled to most of the halls that I've studied. They have obtained acoustical data that give guidance to all the readers of my books on how to produce halls that will make attendance at concerts a pleasure. And these engineers are Dr. Takayuki Hidaka, Dr. Noriko Nishihara, and Dr. Toshiyuki Okano of the Takanaka Research and Development Institute of Chiba, Japan. Now, about credits, I should say that my lecture today is taking place from the firm called Ascentec, A-C-E-N-T-E-C-H, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they're very kind to let us come here and speak to you over this system that you're viewing today. And I thank Ascentec. The principal measures of acoustical quality that are generally agreed to and which these guys measure are reverberation time. And that's the time it takes for a loud sound to die to inaudibility. And it's sometimes called the fullness of tone because it drags the tone on. Or since you sit there and the reverberation takes place around you, you say it is envelopment of the listener. Then, of course, when you're sitting in the hall, the loudness is important. You don't want a weak sound. And if you make the hall very, very large, like 5,000 seats, the strength goes down because the orchestra sound has to be divided up among more people. And then there's a quantity of warmth, which is the strength of the bass sounds. And then there's the binaural quality index, which is a very important measurement that is called spaciousness. And this means that the sound that you're listening to in front of you seems to come from a wider source. The source seems to be broadened. We call that spaciousness. And this measure, of course, is closely allied with the width of a hall. And what creates this quality is that you get side reflections off the side walls and off the ceiling. If they come in at your ear in the right way, you get a high binaural quality index. If they come at your ear in kind of unfavorable ways, due to the way the hall is shaped, then the quality index goes down. Then there's something called the initial time delay gap. If you're sitting in a hall, you will get the direct sound coming to you, and you'll get the sound from first reflections that arrive from the side walls, and usually that means that what happens is closely allied to the width of the hall. The difference between the arrival time of the direct sound and the arrival time of the first reflections is called the initial time delay gap. There's nothing in that gap between the two. Then finally you get surface diffusivity, which is irregularities on the walls and ceiling, and they must be large enough to give the reverberation of a mellow tone. So let us look at some of the best light halls of the world. First one is the Vienna Grosser Musikverein Saal. It opened in 1870. It's the home of the Vienna Philharmonic, a venerable orchestra of Europe. Now, everywhere in this hall, there is gilt, ornamentation, and statuettes. As you can see, this hall is shoebox-shaped. It's rectangular. The superior acoustics are due to its shoebox shape. Its relatively small size, only 1,680 seats, its irregular interior surfaces, and its relatively long reverberation time, 2.0 seconds. The interior is plaster or plaster on concrete block, which makes for a strong bass. Now, its acoustics are similar to those in Boston, except they're louder because of the smaller size. The binaural quality index equals 0.64. Binaural quality index, 0.64. And this is the way that hall looks. You can see the shoebox rectangular shape. There's one balcony, and you can see all the irregularities around the side. And on the lower level, it's done by putting a bunch of statues in, imposing female figures. Then we go to Boston Symphony Hall. This was built in 1900. It's also shoebox in shape. It has a high horizontal coffered ceiling and two wraparound balconies. It resembles Vienna's Grosser Musikverein Saal, but it is different, primarily because it seats 2,625 people compared to 1,680 for Vienna. Now the sound is clear, it's live, it's warm, it's brilliant and loud, without being overly loud. The sound is remarkably uniform in quality throughout the hall. Now the interior surfaces are irregular, and we'll show that in the picture coming up, which gives the reverberation a rich quality. Now, if you look at above the second balcony in the lower diagram, you see there's a lot of open space up there, and that means that the sound can roll around in there, and the reverberation develops very thoroughly. It reaches its maximum effect. This is not possible in halls where the seating on one of the surfaces extends up nearly to the ceiling. Now, the reverberation time in Boston is 1.9 seconds, and the binaural quality index is 0.61. Now, you can look at the Boston Symphony Hall. You see the two balconies. The irregularities are achieved with niches, statues, and in the ceiling you have coffers, irregularities. So these irregularities in there give you some of the rich, reverberant sound. And then the third hall I'm going to show you is the Tokyo Opera City Concert Hall. It has a unique interior shape for a concert hall. It embodies a pyramidal ceiling with its apex reaching 28 meters above the main floor. The architect wanted this pyramid. Now, we were able to make it work. Now, seating 1,636, this hall opened in 1997. Beneath the lighting trough, which is above the top balcony, the hall is shoebox in shape, as you can see in the lower left corner. A property that assures uniform sound throughout the listening spaces. Now, we also found a and this is not in the translator, this is not in your copy, there is a canopy which shows up as sort of a triangular-shaped white space in the upper graph above the orchestra because they do not hear themselves well with that pyramidal ceiling. So it took the added canopy to make them, the orchestra, hear themselves. The acoustical measurements confirm that the hall has optimum occupied reverberation time, 1.96 seconds, excellent clarity, intimacy, spaciousness, warmth, strength of sound. The binaural quality index equals 0.72. Now, I was a design acoustical consultant working with the Takanaka Research and Development Institute. They made the models and took all the acoustical data. Now, this all goes on the next slide, and you will see the pyramidal shape, the hanging surface above the orchestra, and you can see that there are two balconies, and there are irregularities everywhere in the hall. And it turns out this has very excellent acoustics. Now that brings me to opera houses. I decided to make a study of 24 opera houses in Europe, Japan, and the Americas. The seating numbers in these houses vary from 1,125 to 3,816, while the volume and reverberation times occupied, of course, range from 7,000 to 24,700 cubic meters, and the reverberation time from 1.1 to 2 seconds. Now, I mailed questionnaires to 67 important opera conductors. 22 responded, and one response was not usable. The questionnaire asked for acoustical quality ratings of 24 halls on a scale from poor. If you look at the bottom of this thing here, you'll see it goes from poor on the upper end to one of the best, with intermediate steps from passable, good, and very good. And also, they were asked to rate the sound in the audience and the pit separately. The results are given here. Now it came as a surprise. The highest rated opera house in the world is the Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires. It was no surprise, of course, that the venerable Milan La Scala and the Dresden Semper Oper came in next. Normally you would think because they're so famous, they would be on top. Unfortunately, some of the houses were rated less than good. Now, these houses, in some cases, were big houses. Other cases, they were sort of odd-shaped rooms. And two of those were in Berlin, as you can see in the left. Two were in Berlin, those not-so-good houses. There's one in Chicago. There was a great big hall in Tokyo, and an opera house in Rome that didn't come through so well. The very largest opera house with 3,800 seats, is the New York Metropolitan Opera, and it came in right in the middle. In fact, the acoustics in it are quite good, except being so big, they can only hire very strong singers with big voices. And that means that the number of operas they can put on is cut down some because you can't always get big voices for all the operas. And as you go up here, you'll find that there are other, Munich, Paris, Prague, and so forth, have good opera houses. And three of those, the pit is better, it was deemed to be better than the house, as you can see on the right-hand side. There are three dots. Now let's go to the Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires. It's larger than most opera houses in Europe. It seats 2,487, plus some standees. It has the usual horseshoe shape. And besides the main floor, there are six rings, plus a standees area at the top. The sound is remarkably uniform, although some listeners prefer the top two rings because of augmented sound from the main ceiling. Performers say the house responds easily to their singing and the orchestra does not drown out the singers. Now the reverberation time occupied is 1.6 seconds, and this is about 2/10 of a second above the average for other houses. Now the acoustical measurement, which is a binaural quality index, is 0.65, is larger than that for all the other opera houses for which data are readily available. Now, this shows, if you look on the right-hand lower side, that a concert shell is erected on the stage for symphonic concerts. The hall is surprisingly good for the standard symphonic repertoire. In the next slide, if you've been there, you know this looks familiar with the rings showing up on either the left and the right side. And the chairs are of the type you see here. Then we go to the Staatsoper in Vienna, which of course is a world-famous opera house. It's horseshoe-shaped. It's relatively small, seating 1,709. Compared to the New York Metropolitan Opera House, which has 3,816 seats, and San Francisco with 3,252 seats, it really is a miniature. Now, it was rated slightly lower than La Scala in Milan, and of course lower than the Teatro Colón, but its small size makes for intimate productions and enables the casting of singers with less than tremendous voices. In reverberation time, it's 1.4 seconds, and the binaural quality index is an excellent 0.62. This house is not used for symphonic concerts. Then I take you to the most recent one that I've been involved with. It's a new national theater opera house in Tokyo. It's one of the recently built ones. It was about 1997. It is relatively small. It seats 1,800, and it's not horseshoe-shaped. Its acoustics were rated equal to the Semper Oper in Dresden and La Scala in Milan. The architect, Takahiko Yanagisawa, states, "The design facilitates the exchange of energies between those on stage and those attending the performance. The people in the audience are stationed so that they can, are positioned so that they surround the stage as much as possible, and the balconies encourage empathy among them as they face each other across the hall." Now the hall's reverberation time, 1.5 seconds. The binaural quality index is an excellent 0.65. This house is not used for symphonic concerts. I am the design acoustical consultant, and I worked again with Takanaka Research and Development. They made the model and took all the acoustic data. Just one point, looking at these, you'll find that the balconies do not extend much over the audience. If you look carefully in the upper one, you find a little fine line across the top and across the back and the bottom, which show where the balcony comes in above the people on the main floor. And you see that these balconies do not cover up many people on the main floor. Now the picture on the next slide, you can see the three balconies and the audience areas. Now, one feature that is in no other opera house, and I tried to put it in there, is that as you go from the proscenium toward the audience, you have something that's almost shaped like the bell on a trumpet. And over the proscenium, you can see that shape, which is like a bell on a trumpet. And if you go to the fronts of the balconies, you find that they shape out like a bell on a trumpet. And this means that you get a better amplification of the singers' voices in the audience do this bell shape like a trumpet, and it does not amplify the orchestra sound, so the singers can be heard easily above the orchestra, which can be quite loud. That ends my talk. I hope parts of it are of interest.
Bueno, ahora podemos hacer preguntas, quienes así lo deseen.
Can you hear me, Dr. Beranek? Can you hear me, Dr. Beranek?
Yes.
Okay. Shall we start with the question and answer?
Well, if you have some questions, I'll try and answer them.
Si ustedes tienen preguntas, él va a tratar de contestar.
Están todos tan emocionados que no pueden.
Everybody is so moved they cannot even open their mouth.
Well, they don't have to be questions, you know.
Bueno, no es obligatorio hacer preguntas. Then we have a question here, Dr. Beranek.
En español, por favor. De la primera parte, Dr. Beranek.
From your first part, Dr. Beranek.
Los silenciadores que usted diseñó y construyó.
The mufflers that you designed and built.
Son de sección muy amplia.
Have a very wide section.
Supongo que obtuvo un segundo beneficio que debe ser una muy baja contrapresión.
I assume you had a second benefit that was a very low back pressure.
That's the question.
Exactly. And that was only accomplished with having these very large open spaces. There were six of them, 3 by 3 meters.
Bueno, yo aprovecho y hago una pregunta que no tiene nada que ver con acústica, sino que nos contara un poquito.
Dr. Miyara is very interested to hear some comments from you about your stay in Argentina.
Well, it was a very interesting time. I suppose that Argentina has changed much since that period. Of course, we were having inflation already in Argentina, and I learned something I didn't never seen in our country, was that people tended to get their pay on Friday and spend it all as fast as possible because the inflation made their pay worth less even the next week, and I never seen anything like that before. The other thing that interested me, there was many what you might call chances. You could go and get a chance. You give some money for a ticket, and you get a chance to buy a motorcycle or a bicycle or a house. People were buying things by taking chances with these tickets, and I'd never seen that in our cities, which was an interesting thing. Now, on the Casa Florida in those days, we had wonderful stores with very nice things to buy. I hope they're still there. And at the one end of the Casa Florida was the Banco de Boston. I don't know whether it's still there or not. But these were things that I remember from the trips. Now, I did have a run-in once with a woman. I was taking photographs with my camera. And the woman came screaming to me and said that I had taken her picture, which I had not. And she made such a noise that the policeman came. and he took both me and the woman to the police station. And she at the police station was saying that that I was taking her picture and I didn't have no right to do that. And I explained to them I was a professor in the University of Buenos Aires, and finally I saw the jefa there, the chief policeman who was hearing the case, and he turned to somebody and went like this, indicating that she was crazy. So they gave me no trouble.
Muchas gracias por la respuesta.
Thank you very much for your answer.
¿Hay alguna otra gente que quiera preguntar? Yo quisiera preguntar si nos puede contar cuál fue la circunstancia que hizo que el libro Acoustic fuera traducido primero al castellano, segundo por un ingeniero argentino y tercero que fuera editado en Argentina cuando había montones de posibilidades en el mundo de que lo hicieran otros.
He is very interested in knowing why your book Acoustic. What were the circumstances that led to the book being translated, unpublished in Argentina, and being translated also by an Argentinian engineer, since there are so many possibilities in the world, so many choices for you to have it translated into Spanish in somewhere else?
Well, but the Acoustics book was translated in Argentina into Spanish. That was the book back in 1955 or so, if that is your question. Now, my other books have not been translated into Spanish. They've been translated in other languages, but not Spanish.
Dr. Baranek, the question is, why was it translated in Argentina, and why it was it translated by an Argentinian engineer?
But I can't answer that. All I know is that's what happened.
No puedo darle una respuesta. Lo único que sé es que eso fue lo que pasó.
¿Alguien quiere formular alguna otra pregunta? Aprovechen porque es realmente una oportunidad irrepetible.
Buen día. Tengo una pregunta acerca de las clasificaciones que se hicieron para las salas de concierto y ópera.
He'd like to know about your ratings of the concert halls and opera houses.
Quería saber qué le parece del aspecto visual, más allá de la acústica, en las clasificaciones. Quiero decir, cómo es el diseño acústico, si tuvo una influencia en la clasificación.
Did the visual, the acoustic design, the look of the house influence the ratings?
Well, you know, there always are hidden factors that come into any building getting a good reputation. One is how comfortable are the seats that you sit in. And indeed, if the house is interesting and beautiful, I think you're going to believe the music sounds better. I agree. I think the appearance of the house does make an effect.
Tiene una influencia, ejerce un efecto.
Ejerce un efecto en la acústica o en la opinión de la gente de esa acústica.
Do you think that it has an effect on acoustics or it has an effect on people's opinion of the acoustics?
Well, of course, the shape of the house is a factor in how well the hall sounds. As I pointed out, a rectangular hall with all these features that you find in the Boston Hall make it a very good hall. But if you only have smooth sidewalls, which will make it look different, if the ceiling is different, it may sound different. So the shape in the hall does influence the acoustics. Now, all I'm saying is if the architecture is pleasant, it means that the hall will be better light, even though the acoustics may not be perfect. But you can't have bad acoustics that is compensated for by how the architects look.
La acústica se puede quedar compensada hasta un cierto punto por la arquitectura y por lo placentero del diseño.
A mí me gustaría saber, que no está directamente relacionado quizás con el tema de salas, es si alguien que ha estudiado tantas salas estudió música y qué tipo de música y autores prefiere.
Somebody that has studied so many concert halls and theaters like you have you ever studied any music? If you have studied music, what kind of music do you prefer and which are your favorite authors?
Well, you know, there are several operas that I will go to any time I have a chance. I'm, of course, very interested in Verdi's music and his operas. And, of course, they vary. Different ones of Verdi's operas are different, and I paid a lot of attention to them. And I suppose I like very much La Traviata and Aida. And Otello, I think those operas are very things I will go to. But one of some of my favorites is a Wagner Meistersinger. I like it very much. And, of course, La Bohème is always one of the great ones. The music is just wonderful in La Bohème.
And, sir, Dr. Baranek, have you studied music yourself?
Not really. I took lessons on the piano. But the answer is yes.
Bueno, la respuesta es sí.
But a long time ago.
Pero hace muchísimo tiempo.
When I was in
college,
that was in Cornell College
in
Iowa,
en la facultad,
I took
Iowa,
lessons on the timpani from the timpani player in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And I played timpani when I was in college. And then when I went to Harvard University, I played timpani in the Harvard Orchestra. But then I got too busy after that and never played timpani again.
Después de esa época.
Nuevamente, profesor Veranek, me interesa su opinión sobre lo siguiente. Respecto a los circuitos eléctricos o acústicos, la resolución de circuitos.
With regard to acoustic and electrical circuits and their resolution.
Utilizar como sistema a las ecuaciones de nodo.
To use node equations as a system.
Y reemplazar el resto de las ecuaciones por la minimización de la disipación de potencia en todo
and
el circuito.
And to replace the rest of the equations for the
minimización de potencia.
Minimizing the power.
Transformarlo en un problema lineal, en un problema,
that is, to turn it into a problem of linear resolution.
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry. It's.
¿Podría repetir la pregunta, específicamente la pregunta?
Sí, primero debo entenderlo bien yo.
He says that to make a good question, first he has to understand it clearly. So the question doesn't come out very clearly because there's not a clear understanding either. Yes.
Para algunos circuitos,
for some circuits,
probé como método de resolución.
For some circuits, I tried as a resolution method.
En lugar de utilizar todas las ecuaciones usuales de nodos y de mallas,
instead of using all the usual node and web equations,
utilizo las ecuaciones de nodo,
using node equations,
y reemplacé el resto,
and I replace the rest of the equations,
por la minimización de la disipación de potencia en el circuito.
Minimizing the dissipation of power within the circuit.
Cuando uno lo plantea como una ecuación lineal de, para minimizarla.
When you think of it as a linear equation to minimize it,
con las ecuaciones de nodo como sus restricciones,
with the node equations,
al menos en algunos circuitos pude resolverlo.
I could solve them at least in some circuits.
Lo que quisiera saber si usted tiene noticias sobre si ese es un método general.
Do you think that this could be a general method?
Well, I of course would have to see what you're exactly doing, but it seems to me the answer is yes.
Exactamente qué es lo que usted está haciendo, pero me parece que la respuesta puede llegar a ser que sí.
Yeah.
Would it be possible for you to give an answer by mail? Could he send you this question by mail, and would you be so kind as to reply by mail?
Well, send it by email.
I'm sorry, I should have said email. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Of course I will answer.
Sí, por supuesto que les va a mandar la respuesta por email.
Me gustaría preguntarle al profesor, ¿qué papel ha jugado la fisiología del oído en su especialidad?
What was the role of ear physiology in your specialty? What was the role of the physiology of the ear in your specialty, in your field?
Well, It's hard to make an answer to this because the ear is what we're listening with. And of course, with normal hearing, you will get the full range of frequencies in the concert hall. And what we found was that in this binaural quality index, which we talked about, it's measured by putting microphones in the two ears and then making a comparison of what comes through by the cross-correlation coefficient between the signals from the two ears. If the signals are exactly alike, the sound in the concert hall would be very poor. If the signals that get to the two ears are considerably different, then you get better sound quality, which means it's a mixture of waves in the room that build to sound quality, and it has to get the sound of the two ears in the right way.
Y eso que significa que la onda de sonido llega a los oídos en la forma correcta.
Another question.
Buenos días, profesor Veranek. Quería hacerle una consulta respecto a, me gustaría conocer su opinión respecto a las nuevas técnicas de evaluación de las salas de concierto y las salas de ópera basadas en la que hace unos años empezaron a realizar, basadas en la respuesta al impulso en las distintas posiciones de una sala y los parámetros derivados.
He'd like to know your opinion about the new ratings of concert halls based on the response to the impulse.
Sí, impulso response y los parámetros derivados de ella como claridad, definición.
Impulse response and the parameters derived from it, like clarity, time.
Central time.
Central time.
Well, I personally don't pay much attention to center time, but certainly clarity, which is a so-called C80, clarity index, that is commonly used, which measures the ratio of the energy after 80 milliseconds to the energy before 80 milliseconds that reaches your ear. That's an important one. The impulse method is what we use to get the binaural quality index. So, therefore, the impulse method is very important.
El pulso es muy importante.
¿Alguien quisiera hacer alguna otra pregunta?
Okay. Quisiera agradecer.
I would like to thank you.
Por el gran aporte que ha hecho
for
su trabajo,
the extraordinary work you have done
en la formación de los nuevos acústicos que
in teaching new generation of acousticians.
Well,
bueno, y terminar al menos mi intervención con una pregunta.
And I would like to ask a last question.
Respecto a qué significa para usted la acústica en su vida.
What is acoustics? What does acoustic mean in your life? What's the meaning of acoustics in your life? What's the importance of acoustics in your life?
Well, there are three things to say on that. One is certain kinds of acoustics, like listening to music, is a pleasure. It makes life worth living. The second kind of acoustics is solving problems, much as you would solve any problem. It gives you great pleasure to be able to solve a problem, to find a way of doing something new. And the third thing is teaching. Teaching acoustics to young people has been one of the happiest things in my life.
Ha sido uno de los factores más agradables, más felices de mi vida.
Yo quería preguntar cuántas videoconferencias ha dado aproximadamente.
Dr. Engineer Mijara wants to know how many video conferences have you given approximately?
A lot. I never thought of counting them, but certainly you're in the hundreds.
Pero más de 100 cientos, están en por los cientos.
¿Alguien tiene alguna otra pregunta?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Durani.
It's been a pleasure to listen to you, and we are in gratitude. Very
and I thank you for letting me appear before the Acoustical Society of Argentina. It's been a privilege, and I'm very happy to have the opportunity.
Estoy muy feliz de haber tenido esta oportunidad.
Thank you very much, Dr. Durani.